Thank you so much. I want to start with some sort of personal information. A couple of weeks ago, I was at a conference in Berlin, and this was a very weird feeling for me. I'm teaching and working in Sweden, but I come from Germany. And we just had a couple of days before an election in Sweden, and we now have an openly racist party in parliament in Sweden. And it was weird coming back to Germany. I always assumed that Germany was more racist, but we'll see what comes out of it. It's really, people are still very upset. I mean, we're really emotional about that. Since then, other things had happened. There was a transgender conference in the city where I live, in Malmö, and two trans women from Turkey were abused on the street and abused by the police afterwards. And since then, of course, we hear the stories from the US about young people who decide that taking their lives is the most viable options for them at the moment. So there's lots going on, and I want to take the personal also. And I also want to see if these stories are linked. I'm not really sure they are linked directly, but I will try to channel part of my anger, part of my sadness into something hopefully useful, tracing some deep-rooted linkages between racism and homo and transphobia. And I am, of course, looking very much forward to your own questions and ideas afterwards, and I will try to leave us some time for discussions. And if you want to interrupt me during my talk, just raise a hand and we'll clarify. In public debates, children and notions of the best interest of the child are used to dramatize and limit societal negotiations of sexuality and sexualities, and Pellegrini argues. And while the world, is mourning Tyler Clementi, Seth Walsh, Asher Brown, and Billy Lucas, it also becomes clear that their deaths are not merely caused by one person's bullying, but reflect the structural choices and societal discourses that make queer kids and students invisible, and that allow for discrimination to continue. School policies, or many school policies in Canada and Sweden and Germany, don't really actively include queered young people. There are no obvious traces of queer young people in these policies, or most of these policies. In that sense, queer kids and their teachers are invisible in school. The spectacle of redress when a queer kid chooses to complain, or the publicity of mourning that we experience at the moment, cruelly underline the normalcy of invisibility. With my presentation today, I will engage notions of youth and child with Joan Scott's concept of secularism, and we'll try to say that word later, and Josbjørn Puhle's problematization of homonationalism. How can these concepts help in reading and analyzing education frameworks and in analyzing notions of youth? In the face of empirical evidence of discrimination against queer kids and teachers, I am trying to understand some of the continuities and implications, as well as my own possible implicatedness in structures of inclusion. I am now in Canada to meet teachers and education experts to learn more about their knowledges about lesbian, gay, bisexual, two-spirit, transgender, transsexual, intersex, queer kids. And while it's too early to offer any sustained analysis from the interviews, of course, I will make references to some of the arguments by the people who spoke with me. And I would like to stress that for me, this is not about identities, but about norms and regulations that in good old queer manner need to be understood and addressed. Therefore, I'm using the term queered to describe the interrelation of self-identification and ascription. And as Lisa Lutzenheiser points out, and is she here today? There has been a tendency amongst those who research marginalized youth to view social groups or identities as fixed units of analysis. Although speaking of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender youth, or queer, as a monolithic group may offer the most clearly rendered representations, it is deeply problematic. Thus, with queered, I'm referencing experiences from anti-racist thinking and activism and the use of the term racialized. While I do not want to set a queer us in the passive form, I wish to point to the processes of being queered in education context and in research, the ascription of otherness, regardless of personal identifications. The inscription of specific queer subjectivities in our analysis is important for emancipatory purposes, and on the same account productive of belongings in many ways. In the words of Osimonios, all children are not the privileged white babies to whom contemporary society caters, so we have to be clear who we're really talking about when we say child. My primary interest in the research I'm currently doing at schools, including the policy frameworks. Yet, by using the term teaching sex in my title today, I'm referring to the discourses and processes that teach students, as well as the adults around them, the norms and regulations of gender and sexualities. Thus, it involves hallway bullying as much as the academic content taught in the classroom, teachers' attitudes, and more indirectly, the research we do and discuss on education and on young people. It is school culture as well as school policy and the pop images we produce and consume that give young people knowledge about how they can and cannot inscribe themselves into groups and societies. I find this very broad definition useful as it reflects the embeddedness of schools in societal negotiations. And it also reflects those who are not able or allowed to take part in institutionalized schooling. And this is also why I'm interested in the concepts of secularism and sexularism and homonationalism, as they seem to help me to understand some of the brick walls I seem to bang my head against in understanding discrimination. Allow me to discuss the concepts. In her lecture titled Sexularism, Joan Scott, she held this lecture last year, so that's a new discussion in a way, Joan Scott calls into question the simple oppositions modern traditional, secular religious, sexually liberated, sexually oppressed, gender equality, patriarchal hierarchization, West-East. Scott's slip of the finger, she's explaining how she misspelled all the time the word secularism and came up with sexualism in writing. And it is, if you look at the keyboard, it's next to each other. So this slip of the finger of the term secularism offers reflection of the implicatedness of Western secularisms with current attempts to other sexism and homophobia. Scott's analysis of the history of secularism and of Enlightenment arguments as inherently sexist is highly relevant to understand this implicatedness. She argues for a nuanced analysis of the heredity and current uses of the notion of secularism. She's saying, but I want to take the argument further and suggest that it is not at all clear that secularism is a sufficient historic explanation for the admittedly more open, flexible kinds of sexual relations that have gained acceptance in some countries in the West in recent years. When we begin to untangle the strands that are these days taken to be the whole package, we find a much more complex story than the one that ties secularization inevitably to sexual emancipation. And I urge you to read the text. It's a compelling story to see how she traces secularism. And she does that with a triple analysis, discussing the indeed sexist history of secularization, as well as the reflection of the notion of individual agency and its role in our understanding of secularism. And lastly, she argues that from a psychoanalytical perspective, secularism has not resolved the difficulties that sexual difference poses for social and political organizations. It is rather one of the frames within which those difficulties are addressed and managed. So she's saying secularism is not the solution, but one of the ways we communicate. So what she's saying is that more secularism might not do the trick. Just a shouting louder does not necessarily make for better communication. Rather, the assumed neutrality of sexual argumentation produces quite specific practices of communication and negotiation to the exclusion of others. And of course, I'm trying to figure out what that has to do with my field and education. And Pellegrini offers a suggestion as to why this might be useful for the field of education. She says that twins of modernity, the child and the secular, underwrite moral claims about progress, the universal human, and the ordering of time itself. If the child is the fulcrum for the reproduction of relations of inequality, school is the lever. So she's putting it right into my field, into youth research, into education research. Read this way, both the notion of the child and the idea of a secular future are not only intertwined, but can be seen as mechanisms of Western nation-building processes. And that brings me to the idea of homonationalism. Homonationalism is a term suggested by Jasbir Poor, as I mentioned, and it reflects Lisa Dugan's notion of homonormativity. the new homonormativity, she argues, is a politics that does not contest dominant heteronormative assumptions and institutions, but upholds and sustains them while promising the possibility of a demobilized gay constituency and a privatized, depoliticized gay culture anchored in domesticity and consumption. Again, we heard this discussion, and she wrote this in 2003. So but what happens is that Pua takes up this discussion. Dugin's critique of neoliberalism and imperialist market politics includes critical reflections of politics that demand inclusion of queer subjects into the social status quo, rather than challenging that status quo. Drawing on Judith Butler's critique of Nancy Fraser's arguments about redistribution as in class struggle and recognition as in cultural politics, Dugin points out that all kinds of politics are hybrid forms. There can't only be redistribution, there can't only be recognition. In her book, Terrorist Assemblages, Homo Nationalism in Queer Times, Pua offers a critique of the nation's incorporation, and in her case, it's specifically in the US, of queer subjectivities for imperial purposes, and in turn, the complicity of queer subjects and communities in such imperial projects. Homo nationalism addresses how queer subjects actively enter into the imaginary of the nation and how the nation is using its imagining of queer communities in the intensification of power. Pua also refers to the limitations of politics of recognition pointed out by Dugin. The politics of recognition and incorporation entail that certain, but certainly not most, homosexual, gay, and queer bodies may be the temporary recipients of the measures of benevolence that are afforded by liberal discourses of multicultural tolerance and diversity. And she's working through various issues such as consumer cultures, as in queer tourism, that are implicated in constructing gay-friendly and non-gay-friendly nations, normalized gay and lesbian human rights frames, and the adoption of feminist discourses in conservative politics to dissect the machinery of war that is the war on terror in the US. Pua even suggests, and now it gets painful, a contingency of growing racism and the stabilizing of queer. The ascendancy of queer is not just coincidentally occurring in relation to certain racial politics, but is contingent upon them. We also know that any single access identity politics is invariably going to coagulate around the most conservative, normative construction of that identity, foreclosing the complexities of class, citizenship status, gender, nation, and perhaps most importantly, in the context of very recent events, religion. This is, of course, no easy read. As Pua challenges staples both in feminist and queer self-understandings, the assumption of our critical edge. She reminds her readers that this we was never won, and that the gaining of civic rights for some does not, frustratingly, necessarily mean the increase in rights for all. Perversely, queer Western subjects who are struggling nationally for social and political survival are made discursively to full global citizens. Through the transnational production of terrorist corporealities, she argues, homosexual subjects who have limited legal rights within the US, and you can put your Germany, Sweden, Canada, within these civil contexts, gain significant representational currency when situated within the global scene of the war on terror, because we don't get killed for it, very simply put. This discourse of full membership for Western queers that is created through the opposition of selected non-Western queer subjects does not reflect the experiences of many queer subjects within Western societies. And I just remember that moment 2 weeks ago in Malmö when those trans women were bashed. In turn, the discussion of non-Western queers and their suffering is located in specific geopolitical spaces through the war on terror discourse. So Pua suggests to reread events such as changes in legislation that are considered positive in terms of sexuality for the wider implications. This rereading is, she argues, a potent tactic for destabilizing of homophobia versus racism binary. Before I came to Vancouver, I applied to do research both with public school teachers and with teachers in Catholic schools. the Catholic school board decided against approval at this moment, which is, of course, the point of an application, that access can indeed be denied. I'm trying to get beyond reading this as a statement of the seemingly obvious that the Catholic school system in Canada is closed and discriminating for queer students and teachers. Yes, I've read both the media events around queer students and teachers in Catholic schools in Canada and academic reflections of the issue. Yes, I do see a problem, but I would like to suspend my own reflexes and think about Janet Jacobson's and Anne Pellegrini's suggestion about secularism again. Sorry, very long quote. Specifically, secularism is central to the Enlightenment narrative in which reason progressively frees itself from the bonds of religion and in so doing liberates humanity. This narrative poses religion as a regressive force in the world, one that in its dogmatism is not amenable to change dialogue or nonviolent conflict resolution. This Enlightenment narrative separates secularism from religion and through this separation claims that secularism, like reason, is universal, in contrast to the particularism of religion. I am asking myself the question of the limits of secularism on two accounts. First, I'm curious about the conversations that might open up once I suspend my own belief in secularism. And second, I wonder about the three theoretical challenges I need to put myself, seeing that a lot of the thinking I do and the frameworks I'm working with rely implicitly or explicitly on notions of the secular as sine qua non. Jacobson and Pellegrini discuss also, if secularism is a world discourse, what kind of world does it imagine? And what kind of universalism does it put in place? Does secularism protect against conflict? Or if secularism is not, in fact, universal, is it one of the terms through which the conflicts of today's world are enacted? And that goes, in a way, back to Scott asking about our means of communication. Of course, I do ask myself these questions as someone who lives in Europe, a region of the world that seems to condone racism in ways that seemed impossible in the light of historic knowledge, such as the deportation of Roma from France and the blatant discrimination in most societies. In Germany, where I received my academic education and grew up, the recent years have seen a swift positioning of homophobia with religiously and ethnically othered people. Judith Butler's turning down of the award for civil courage at the mainstream Pride event earlier in this year in Berlin has flashed a light on this issue when she pointed out that the struggle against homophobia always needs to go hand in hand with the struggle against racism. And I have the links for you. Her speech is online. It's in German, but it has the subtext. The event highlighted the discursive formation popular in Germany and in Sweden that posits homophobia in migrant subjects, and especially in young migrant men. Migrant, in the German context, can mean many experiences and often refers to people whose grandparents or parents came to Germany. Especially people of color and people othered through Islamophobia are categorized in this way. This othering absolves mainstream German society of the ongoing structural and cultural homophobia that can be witnessed, for example, in school curricula. Yet, from what I hear from my research participants here in Vancouver, this is not a German issue only. That gay bashings in Vancouver are represented to be an imported problem does not reflect the realities of queers of color who receive negative attention from white Canadians. It does not reflect that the people racialized in New Canadians might not have any relationship with their parents' community of origin. I just don't know that. And that there might be, as one of my research participants argued, whiter as white, regardless their color of skin. This produces insiders and outsiders and creates universal notions of insider queerness that is specifically racialized. And it produces a focus on the seemingly visible. There's one statement I've made myself and that I heard also in the research interviews we had. That in 2010, homophobia and transphobia should be things of the past. We are incredulous that in this day and age, discrimination based on perceived gender identity or sexuality are still part of the societal structure and social cultural realities. Such statements reflect a discourse on time that expects things to get better. Interestingly, two of the research participants commented on the YouTube clip by US author Dan Savage. I'm not sure if you've seen them. And his partner Terry, it gets better, and it's a whole, I mean, many people have contributed to this project. It's aimed at young people in high school who experience homophobia or transphobia, and the clip uses biographical narrative to tell viewers that it is possible, even after years of growing up in conservative religious environments and under severe harassment, to have a happy and successful life that includes a child and a very middle class lifestyle, if only you stick around. As important as these stories are certainly for young people to see at this moment, I'm not arguing against it. One of the research participants was skeptical. For them, telling a trans kid that it gets better would not reflect reality. Also, why should anyone have to wait for an indefinite future? Tough it out, as Savage puts it, and go through the trauma of harassment. Read through the critique of secularism, this notion of change in the future can be contextualized. I'm going back to Jacobson and Pellegrini. These moves away from religion and towards the secular reached full flower in the European Enlightenment and in the formation of modern nation states. Implicit within the narrative is the idea that each step forward in time also marks a moral advance. A move away from religious authority and toward greater intellectual freedom and more knowledge, leading eventually to governance by reasoned debate and ultimately to democracy and peace. It is a tempting tale that is ingrained in the fabric of Western nation states. It also creates an unlikely consensus between the religious right and the secular left, that especially Islam, especially if allowed to leave the private sphere, threatens, and this is a quote, threatens this civilization and leads to violence. Yet, as Molly McGarry argues, the political spectrum that positions religion as always already at odds with queer subjects not only construes the idea of religious homosexuals, for example, as either oxymoronic or just moronic, but also raises significant structures of belief that, at least in moments, sustain progressive politics. And I think those both levels are important to see that it does something with our thinking, but it also makes certain subjectivities impossible, this separation. Again, what does all that have to do with education? And how do these critiques of homonationalism and secularism become relevant for schools and education frameworks? Going back to Pellegrini, she says that Poor's analysis also supports an expanded investigation into the interpolating call of the child. How is the reproduction of relations of living and dying, Poor's words, secured through the fiction of the universal child? Once more with feeling. What do children learn in school? The attachment of children and young people to the future, a by necessity ill-defined time that is emotionally charged with visions of progress and improvement, needs to be understood as limited to some specific young people, as Munoz has reminded us, and is clearly complemented by the death, figuratively or literally, but of those young people who do not figure in this image of the future. Both approaches, secularism and homonationalism, help disentangle assumptions of universal subjects. In my own reading of school policies, the student is such a universal subject, and schools are created as seemingly value-free spaces, or spaces created by one specific set of values, if we go into Catholic school or denominational school systems, that become default in the same way as the secular neutrality. In an interview with two teachers last week, this was a central point of their analysis, that their colleagues have an understanding of teaching that is neutral, does not reflect specific positions, which problematize their specific position. Of course, this is an argument that has been presented in queer feminist and anti-racist research for many decades, and it is at the center of critical human rights debates. For indeed, who is considered human in human rights? Who is that student imagined by educators and policymakers? And who is the queer kid activists and researchers imagine? On the other hand, once the particular emerges, there seems to be an apparent checkmate, a situation that recreates the assumption that students and parents are either queer or religious. Thus, in their 2007 study in Toronto, Andrea Daly, Stephen Solomon, Peter Newman, and Faye Mishner point out the need to understand the intersectionalities of bullying experienced by LGBT youth. For some LGBT youth, they say, Bullying may not be about sexual orientation or gender or race, ethnicity, or newcomer citizenship status. Rather, it may be about how sexual orientation and gender and race, ethnicity, and newcomer citizenship status intersect to define their experiences. In order to offer viable frameworks for queer and other kids to learn in, we need to learn to live and address the fault lines of secular arguments. With reference to Judith Butler, Mary Lou Rasmussen sums up, and I don't have that on the slide because it's a forthcoming text and that would be naughty. What I'm concerned about in the production of scholarship on sex, sexuality, and sex education, Rasmussen writes, she writes that in the context of schooling, is that religion does not become secularism's other. If sex education is to have relevance to young people, it must reflect and engage the diverse context from which these young people come, even when these contexts cannot be easily reconciled. The turning away from the default position of secular neutrality and the adoption of an active critique of homonational temptations, sorry, the Catholic pun, might open up new modes of thinking and further sustain activism. If we, activists, educators, researchers, want to work beyond the band-aid approach, to borrow Laurie McIntosh's term, of reparative measures for queer kids, it is important to insist that schools are not neutral. And especially in the case of public schools, that they are not neutral secular spaces of reasons where future citizens are shaped. I see that the niches creatively carved out by activists and researchers remain small, and are even turned into decorative elements on the self-shooting wards of liberal nation states. At the same time, and paradoxically, I cannot let go of remedial ideas of emancipatory projects, such as anti-discrimination legislation and human rights discourses. You see, I'm not quite clear here myself, that give queer young people frames of references and retribution. The way I read the present world, such projects are sorely needed. Without such projects, the utopia that makes survival possible would fade away. And finally, I remind myself of central moments of queer, that queer is more than the mere celebration of diverse identities. It is the constant critique of multiple categories of discrimination. We need to bear this ambivalence between analysis and utopia. Thank you.